For the Spanish, Dutch, and British, the costs of war and empire became problems within a generation or two of their imperial zeniths. The economic impact in trade and debt will be discussed in Part 3, but it is appropriate here to note the conflicts that did so much damage. For Spain, the 80 years of off-and-on war in the Netherlands, the Dutch Revolution, beginning in 1570, took on a European and even global breadth in the 30 Years' War, which broke the back of Spanish power. The Dutch, in turn, were obliged to fight France in 1672 when Louis XIV invaded with a huge force, although the results were surprisingly inconclusive. However, the subsequent quarter century of Anglo-Dutch war with France was hard on the United Provinces, not least because their hereditary stadtholder, William of Orange, had also become King of England. The Dutch assumed a larger role than they could afford and paid the price. In retrospect, these wars facilitated England's political and economic emergence at Dutch expense. The next example is all too familiar. Two centuries later, the First and Second World Wars led to the end of the British Empire and announced the arrival of the United States as the new leading world economic power. The Cold War led to a contest between the two military superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, which the United States won in the late 1980s. One unfortunate result was hubris and triumphalism. The obvious question of the 21st century is whether oil, or religion-based conflict in the Middle East, or some broader resource war may punish American overstretch. For such powers past their zenith, religion, our subject in these chapters, is usually one of a larger set of interconnected factors. The need to condense this discussion into a dozen pages results in descriptions and citations that can make these analogies seem too pat. Nevertheless, I have not found any contrary arguments. Typically, that these declines have been exaggerated, at all convincing. Suffice it to say that even at considerable discount, these precedents should unnerve readers weaned on American exceptionalism and unaware of how much doubt prior history casts on that uniqueness. A 21st century American disenlightenment? The frequent byproducts of religious fervor in the later stages of the previous powers, zealotry, exaltation of faith over reason, too much church-state collaboration, or a contagion of crusader mentality, shed light on another contemporary U.S. predicament. Controversies that run the gamut from interference with science to biblically inhibited climatology and petroleum geology and demands for the partial reunion of church and state have accompanied the political rise of Christian conservatism. Such trends are rarely auspicious. The essential political preconditions fell into place in the late 1980s and 1990s with the emergence of the Republican Party as a powerful vehicle for religiosity and church influence, while state Republican parties, most conspicuously in the South and Southwest, endorsed so-called Christian Nation Party platforms. These unusual platforms, as yet nationally uncatalogued, set out in varying degrees the radical political theology of the Christian Reconstruction movement, the tenets of which range from using the Bible as a basis for domestic law to emphasizing religious schools and women's subordination to men. The 2004 platform of the Texas Republican Party is a case in point. It reaffirms the status of the United States as a Christian nation, regrets the myth of the separation of church and state, calls for abstinence instead of sex education, and broadly mirrors the Reconstructionist demand for the abolition of a large group of federal agencies and departments, including the Energy Department and the Environmental Protection Agency. George W. Bush's election to the presidency and his unusual choice of former Missouri Senator John Ashcroft to head the Justice Department were true milestones. We have already seen Bush's involvement in intensifying the religiosity of the Republican Party and in linking White House policy statements to scripture and prophecy. When Ashcroft, a longtime favorite of the religious right, had explored seeking the presidency in 1997 and 1998, most of his financial support came from Christian evangelicals such as Pat Robertson. Conservatives subsequently mobilized in favor of his selection as Attorney General. Son and grandson of Pentecostal preachers, Ashcroft, more than any previous Attorney General, viewed law and politics through a religious lens. He made no effort to shade this connection. In Ashcroft's memoirs, explained one critic, he describes each of his many electoral defeats as a crucifixion and every important political victory as a resurrection, and recounts scenes in which he had friends and family anoint him with oil in the manner of the ancient kings of Israel with each new public office. While in the Senate, Ashcroft enjoyed a 100% approval rating from both the Christian Coalition and the National Right to Life Committee, pleasing the latter by sponsoring a constitutional amendment that extended protection to the unborn at every stage of their biological development, including fertilization, a breadth that might have criminalized birth control. As Attorney General, the Missourian was accused of dragging his heels on the prosecution of abortion clinic bombers. Earlier in his political career, Ashcroft had decried the barrier between church and state as a wall of religious oppression. Midway through the first Bush administration, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a liberal group, condemned his actions as Attorney General. "Whenever cases deal with government funding or promotion of religion," said its spokesperson, "the Justice Department under Ashcroft is always on the side of bringing church and state together." Perhaps, but it is also fair to say that Bush's religious constituencies thrill to the criticisms of such hostile groups. During Ashcroft's time in the Senate, he had also authored successful legislation to let states turn over welfare and other social services to religious providers, a program that George W. Bush embraced as governor of Texas and which helped to inspire his 2001 proposal for federal faith-based initiatives. Where possible, religious agencies would take over the provision of federal social services. When Bush's legislation stalled in the Senate, he used a federal executive order to establish faith-based initiative units in six departments: justice, education, health and human services, housing and urban development, labor, and agriculture, as well as in the Agency for International Development. At the General Services Administration, the office maintenance arm of the federal government, Bush appointees held lunch-hour revival meetings in the front hall, making it seem, in the words of the Washington Post, more like the foyer of a Pentecostal storefront church. The House and Senate lobbies had some of that same look. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay and Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe, chairman of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works, were two who insisted that all the answers were in the Bible, and two-thirds of Republican House and Senate members enjoyed 80% or better voting ratings from groups such as the Christian Coalition, the Traditional Values Coalition, the National Right to Life Committee, and the Family Research Council. Dozens of legislators anxious to be theologically correct competed to maintain perfect ratings. As for the interaction of church and state in the White House, two characterizations peculiar to George W. Bush. His salute from several religious right leaders in 2001 as the national head of their movement and his seeming self-image as someone who spoke for God added to the perception of a unique presidency. That a chief executive could be described in these ways without sparking a heated national debate bespoke the public's willingness to accept religion and authority in the aftermath of September 11th. The way in which Bush White House policies were the application of hard-line, pre-formed doctrine rather than the results of evidence-seeking was explained by two departing and disillusioned officials. Former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill recalled his dismay that ideology dwarfed real-world analysis. "Ideology is a lot easier, because you don't have to know anything or search for anything. You already know the answer to everything. It's not penetrable by facts." John DiIulio, the first head of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, ruefully described the complete lack of a policy apparatus or meaningful, substantive policy discussions, because everything was political, with much of the policy coming from right-wing think tanks and the Christian right. The president was most comfortable with black and white, good versus evil portraiture, acknowledging that nuance was not in his playbook. Anti-intellectualism, which profited George Wallace so much in his 1968 presidential campaign, became a Bush prop too, as in his mockery of high grades during a visit to Yale, his alma mater, to receive an honorary degree in 2002. An unidentified senior administration official dismissed the intellectual elites, what we call the reality-based community, people who believe that solutions emerge from your judicious study of discernible reality. In the Oval Office, instinct, prayer, and faith took precedence. Several cartoonists went so far as to draw Bush in robes like those worn by the Iranian Ayatollahs, and as we saw in Chapter 6, portraits of fundamentalist movements around the world displayed considerable resemblance to those of the George W. Bush administration. Nor was that behavior governed simply by deep commitment to religion and religiosity. Esther Kaplan, in her book With God on Their Side, identified a much narrower worldview. He really isn't interested in faith in general. The president didn't flick an eyelash when the National Council of Churches and the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops opposed his war on Iraq. He didn't listen when the Council on American-Islamic Relations filed a suit challenging the constitutionality of the Patriot Act. When the Union for Reform Judaism announced that an anti-gay marriage amendment would defile the Constitution, the president took no notice. Nor did Bush respond to a joint call signed by 50 prominent Christian leaders, including Richard Cizik of the National Association of Evangelicals and Jim Wallace of Call to Renewal, for policies that promote quality health care, decent housing, and a living income for the poor. His is not an embrace of spirituality or ethics, broadly speaking, or of faith as an important voice among many in the national debate. It is instead an embrace of right-wing Christian fundamentalism. Even more to the point, many of Bush's views exuded a theological correctness that was almost a mirror image of the political correctness displayed by secular liberals in discussing minority groups, women's rights, and environmental sanctity. By 2005, words such as theocrat and theocon were gaining traction in political journalism, and with cause. As religious conservatives became the dominant Republican constituency in the 1990s, their tune became the essential party dance music. Swings to the right and then bows to various church-related partners took over conservative choreography. In Republican politics, theological correctness, call it TC, became a policy-shaping force in determining Middle Eastern geopolitics, combating global AIDS, defining the legal rights of fetuses, pretending that oil was not a cause for the invasion of Iraq, and explaining geological controversies in language compatible with the Book of Genesis. As church congregations became GOP auxiliaries and a host of religious right organizations provided essential scorecards of senators and congressmen up for re-election, the nature of constituency pressure changed from share our values to support our doctrine, or else. A few Republican centrists became openly critical of this juggernaut. Arizona Senator John McCain had criticized the Jerry Falwells, Pat Robertsons, and Bob Joneses during his confrontation with Bush in the 2000 Republican presidential primaries. In 2004, Rhode Island Senator Lincoln Chafee suggested that Bush's "I carry the word of God" posture warranted voter attention. In 2005, Connecticut GOP Congressman Christopher Shays, as we have seen, sparked attention simply by describing the Republican Party as a theocracy. As public skepticism grew, even one-third of self-identified Republicans found themselves critical when poll takers queried whether the religious right had too much or too little influence in Washington. But they were too late. Theology had moved from church pulpits into the decision-making circles of the nation's capital. The Theologization of American Politics: Symptoms and Prescriptions. In the last three chapters, we have seen how the intensity of religion in the late 20th century United States was transforming national politics. By 2001, theology, the yardstick of belief, not judgment, began to displace logic and realpolitik in official Washington, especially within the Republican Party. the impact of conservative religion on national policymaking, which burgeoned under Bush the Younger, is striking and documented, but its effects were so widespread that we need to look at its different components. Several principal areas highlight the extent to which constituency politics began to compel TC. First and foremost were the issues involving birth, life, death, sex, health, medicine, marriage, and the role of the family. High-octane subject matter since the 1970s. These are areas where perceived immorality most excites stick-to-scripture advocates and the religious right. Closely related is the commitment by the Bush White House and the religious right to reduce the current separation between church and state. In the 1960s and 1970s, to be sure, secular liberals grossly misread American and world history by trying to push religion out of the public square, so to speak. In doing so, they gave faith-based conservatism a legitimate basis for counter-mobilization. But in some ways, the conservative countertrend itself has become a bigger danger since its acceleration in the aftermath of September 11th. Topics such as natural resources, climate, global warming, resource depletion, environmental regulation, and petroleum geology, all surprising targets for religious attacks, mark out a third important arena. Such debates draw in the energy industry, automobile producers, utilities, industries that pollute, and the environmental movement, as well as the forces battling for so-called intelligent design, creationism, or the literal interpretation of the Book of Genesis. Major business lobbies, all too aware of the GOP's religious blocs, harness their biases where possible and avoid trespassing on matters of theology. However, governing conservatives in Washington look foolish because of their inability to discuss problems such as global warming and the probability that global oil production is not far from its peak, a silence that goes against the national interest. Chapter 2 has noted the attempt since 1999 of religious conservatives to cloak their side's environmental and energy policy, hitherto largely a matter of property rights, tax incentives, and minimal regulation, in a theology more sophisticated than the brusque Christian Reconstructionist demands for the abolition of the EPA and true believer statements about Genesis 1:28 empowering developers to bring forth the earth's mineral fruits. Organizations such as the Interfaith Council for Environmental Stewardship, ICES, and the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty have enlisted a fair amount of conservative religious and corporate support for preparing what amounts to a pro-business, pro-development explanation of Christian stewardship. The Acton Institute, aided over several years by ExxonMobil, for some time published the Environmental Stewardship Review, given to emphasizing market mechanisms and private property rights. Besides endorsing corporate and development-oriented positions, Acton condemned supposed environmental extremists theologically. The Institute's director, Roman Catholic Father Robert A. Sirico, contends that left-tilting environmentalism is idolatrous in its substitution of nature for God, giving the Christian environmental movement a perhaps unconscious pagan nature. In 2005, a group of theological moderates and liberals convened by the National Council of Churches issued a statement, God's Earth is Sacred, that indicted the conservative credo as a false gospel, that our human calling is to exploit Earth for our own ends alone. One participant, Father Charles Bender, an Orthodox priest, contended that some people say the environment doesn't matter because the second coming of Christ will end the world as we know it. But he called that view the height of arrogance, because each person will have to stand before God and account for his actions. Although few political office holders are involved in this debate, it suggests how theology is imposing itself on, or becoming a necessary appendage to, more and more elements of national policymaking. Then there is the subject matter of business, economics, and wealth, where the tendency of the Christian right is to oppose regulation and justify wealth and relative laissez-faire, tipping its hat to the upper income and corporate portions of the Republican coalition. Christian Reconstructionists go even further, abandoning most economic regulation in order to prepare the moral framework for God's return. These extremes obviously represent instances of theology. Biblical interpretations and priorities, trumping what most would regard as practicality and self-interest. The last arena of theological influence, almost as important as sex, birth, and mortality, involves American foreign policy, bringing us to the connections among the War on Terror, the Rapture, the End Times, Armageddon, and the thinly disguised U.S. crusade against radical Islam. Here, the 43rd president has often coded his remarks to heighten biblical resonance for believers listening for it. A related and important practice, at least an apparent one, is the blurring or avoiding of positions that might contradict the worldview promoted by fundamentalist preachers, inasmuch as senior officials cannot explicitly endorse it. National opinion surveys and the priorities expressed since the late 1970s by church, religious right, and Republican grassroots organizations give precedence to the life and death, sex and family issues over any others. Endless confrontations have arisen over abortion, women's rights, assisted death and the right to die, the promotion of sexual abstinence, contraception, and the question of gay marriage. The spur is the scriptural belief patterns that significantly influence 60-65% of Americans and appear to dominate the views of roughly half that number. Viewpoints on these issues closely reflect the influence of religious denominations, not just religiosity in general. By 2006, more than a half dozen life and death issues, from a vegetative patient's right to die and stem cell research to the question of crimes against fetuses, were grouped in a face-off involving medical and biotechnological criteria and intense theological pressure from religious conservatives to define life, or the right to life, as beginning under the most remote and attenuated circumstances. Conflicting federal and state judicial rulings and legislation on abortion only multiplied the confusion, and the related battle over the use of embryos for stem cell research became incendiary. Citing his reverence for life, George W. Bush blocked federally supported embryonic stem cell research on all but a dozen or so existing cell lines, close to a de facto prohibition. In the House of Representatives, Republican Majority Leader DeLay, a Texan proponent of a biblical worldview, castigated stem cell research that used blastocysts, early embryos of only 100 or so cells, as the dismemberment of living, distinct human beings. That belief prevails among Republican core voters, but the overall electorate, and many elected Republicans, supported stem cell research in order to advance medical and scientific discovery. Foreign policy also found itself in the theological arena. The State Department and other federal agencies took action to block needle exchange and other harm reduction programs in United Nations drug control efforts, to suppress foreign efforts to extend civil rights to sex workers, Brazil persisted in doing so, to defeat international women's treaties, and to keep federal funds from being used to support any international program that funds contraception efforts. Although critics condemned what one called Bush's devotion to his right-wing Christian base, most took hardly any note of one particular theology. The extent to which Christian Reconstructionists supported a move toward biblical law, including the death penalty for homosexuals, adulterers, prostitutes, and drug users. Moderate Reconstructionists, as we will see, support only jail sentences for such people, but still call for punishment of transgressors, not succor. The Terry Schiavo case, in which George W. Bush as president and Jeb Bush as governor of Florida attempted to intervene, pivoted on the right for a patient in a vegetative state to die. In this case, after she had allegedly asserted that choice beforehand to her husband. Voters were offended not by the rulings of the courts and doctors involved, which approved the removal of life support, but by the actions of the Congress and the President in trying to pass special legislation to enable a federal instead of state trial. Some 65-70% of the public objected. Belief that politicians had responded to outside pressure focused popular resentment on the religious right, and many congressmen backed off as the unpopularity of their intervention became clearer. Controversies over life and death, often pivoting on precise definitions of each, can only continue to burgeon. When life begins is a particular pivot. In a federal Food and Drug Administration debate over fertility drugs, Kentucky gynecologist David W. Hager, a Bush appointee to a key advisory committee, prevailed in changing the clinical endpoint in these drug trials from live birth to fetal heart motion. The Federal Unborn Victims of Violence Act, for its part, declared fetuses, defined as a child in utero, attached at any stage of development, to be fully protected persons for the purposes of criminal prosecution. This act paralleled a state statute used by Utah prosecutors to charge a woman with murder when one of her twins was stillborn because, they said, the mother had caused the death by delay in having a C-section. These are not social or values judgments. The arguable rights of women or parents are being displaced by the rights of embryos or by the prerogative of sperm and egg to join. Decisions rooted largely in theology, not science. Perhaps the preoccupation involves maximizing the potential soul count for the hereafter, in the manner of 16th and 17th century inquisitors who ordered that heretics must die even if they repented, yet pursued repentance to save their souls first. Within the Republican Party's most loyal denominations, Southern Baptists, Mormons, and Missouri Synod Lutherans, overall theology accords women secondary status. The essential female role is biblical and familial. Church hierarchies must be male, and not just in these three sects, but in the Assemblies of God, in which women can be ministers but not members of the hierarchy, Roman Catholicism, and the Orthodox Jewish community. Catholics decline to ordain women as priests, and Orthodox Jewish females cannot even study the Torah. In traditionalist constituencies, support for changes like the proposed Equal Rights Amendment of the 1970s has been minimal, opposition to abortion high, and the rights of the unborn weightier than women's rights. In a related vein, conservative publications emphasized the importance in the 2004 election of the baby gap, the data showing that pro-Bush voters have more children than do Democratic voters. The states where white fertility rates were high went conservative, while the states where they were low, most notably Massachusetts, Vermont, and Rhode Island, preferred liberal politics. Conversely, the states where abortion rates were highest supported Kerry. Culturally, the Kerry states ranked higher in number of symphonies or universities and even intelligence quotients, hints that the kind of single people and couples drawn there would put less emphasis on families than did the religious citizenry, more caught up in fecundity and the idea that children are gifts of the Lord. To religious traditionalists, homosexuality threatened the institutions of family and marriage. 11 states held November 2004 referendums to ban gay marriage. In the 7 states where conservative denominations are strong, the proportions carried by huge majorities. 86% in Mississippi, 77% in Georgia, 76% in Oklahoma, 75% in Kentucky and Arkansas, and 66% in Utah and Montana. Church-going black voters, principally Baptists and Pentecostals, supported the curbs by lopsided margins, increasing the anti-gay margins in the Deep South and accounting for much of the small 2004 Republican increase in black support. Secular voters were the principal upholders of gay marriage, which made the balloting much closer in Oregon, for example. Theologically, the conservatism at issue contends that homosexuality is not inherited or God-given, but taken up volitionally, and a sin. Thus, true believers liken practicing homosexuals to adulterers, drug users, or alcoholics, insisting on the individual's ability to make a different choice and rehabilitate themselves. Contrary biological evidence could become as divisive as Darwinism. In all of these matters, the need of Republican office holders and party conventions to be theologically correct puts them through all sorts of contortions. At first, George W. Bush was uncertain about supporting a federal constitutional amendment to prohibit gay marriage. Then pressure from the religious right forced the issue, and he endorsed it on February 24, 2004. When the proposed amendment died in the Senate weeks later, the GOP obtained a small but significant Election Day wedge issue. Ironically, in January 2005, after Bush said there was no need to keep pushing the ban, annoyed religious conservatives threatened to refuse to back his Social Security program unless he changed his mind. He thereupon repeated his support for the constitutional amendment in his February 2nd State of the Union message. The theology of death is cloudier and also riskier politically. Although Bush took a bold and ultimately unpopular stand in the Terri Schiavo case, bending over backward to insist on continuing her life support, blocking death is not the theological equivalent of enabling birth. The Bible abounds with the killing of those already born, both by God and by lawful authorities. Bush himself, as governor of Texas, sent scores of prisoners to the electric chair. Nor has collateral damage to civilians in a just war been a problem. The Lord of Hosts also struck out broadly and bloodily. Donald Akinson, in his study of the peoples of the covenant, cites biblical example upon example. 120,000 men killed in one day, and 200,000 women and children carried away captive. 2 Chronicles 28, 5, 6, and 8. 185,000 Assyrian warriors killed. 2 Chronicles 32, 21. 42,000 Ephraimites put to death because of a minor dialectic variation. 2 Judges 12, 6. Against this backdrop, a couple of thousand Babylonian children killed in what is now Iraq wouldn't have made it into Scripture any more than such possibilities seem to have inhibited the Pentagon in 1991 or 2003. In the Bible, death comes lightly. The next throbbing cluster of issues involves church-state relations. The non-radical theocon wing of the GOP demands a more conservative judiciary and an expanded role for religion in education, social services, and the constraining of immoral behavior, abortion, homosexuality, pornography, and contraception, but avoids spelling out any grand revolutionary mandate. The Christian Reconstructionist movement, by contrast, proclaims ambitions that range from replacing public schools with religious education to imposing biblical law and limiting the franchise to male Christians. Since not many people identify openly as Christian Reconstructionists, the movement's ability to influence U.S. politics in these radical directions is unclear. Most Americans, having never heard of Christian Reconstructionism, likely assume it has only fringe status. The groups that monitor such activists, Theocracy Watch, The Public Eye, The First Amendment Foundation, Church and State Magazine, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and others, take the movement more seriously, however. Their contention is that the Reconstructionists exercise a great deal of indirect influence through the Southern Baptist Convention, the Assemblies of God, Promise Keepers, the Christian Broadcasting Network, the Christian Coalition, the Conservative Council for National Policy, and other groups that share many of their less radical perspectives. That is plausible, given the array of lesser Christian right figures who, while denying they are Reconstructionists, admit to agreeing with some of their positions. Journalist Frederick Clarkson quotes Reconstructionist theoretician Gary North, for many years a member of the Council for National Policy, claiming that his element's ideas have penetrated into Protestant circles that for the most part are unaware of the original source of the theological ideas that are beginning to transform them. The three major legs of the Reconstructionist movement are the Presbyterian-oriented educators, the Baptist school headmasters and pastors, and the charismatic telecommunications system. North refers here not to mainline Presbyterianism, but to several independent fundamentalist denominations, the Presbyterian Church of America and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, that broke away from the national church over doctrinal differences. The connection with the Southern Baptist Convention is difficult to measure. In 2004, Clarkson alleged that the Reconstructionists have taken over the Southern Baptist Convention's national leadership. An SBC spokesman, John Revell, acknowledged that his denomination and the theocrats agree on many issues, from biblical infallibility to male primacy in family and church governance, but that only a small minority of SBC adherents supported theocracy. Clarkson countered that the SBC backs a politics of majoritarianism, popular political mobilization, behind an essentially religious agenda. On the other hand, Reconstructionist ties to the Assemblies of God have been important since Pat Robertson mobilized their superchurches for his 1988 presidential campaign. Attorney General John Ashcroft, son and grandson of AOG preachers, was perhaps the best example of a high Bush administration official whose policies had some Reconstructionist coloration. Robertson himself was an open advocate of the so-called Restoration Acts cited in Chapter 6, and Herb Titus, the one-time dean of the law school at Robertson's Regents University, was involved in crafting them. At very least, all three legislative proposals are building blocks for ending the separation between church and state. If ever enacted as a group, they would signal a far-reaching upheaval in U.S. politics and government. Parenthetically, both George W. Bush and Florida Governor Jeb Bush drew on thinkers and administrators with ties to Reconstructionism in their implementation of faith-based social services. Marvin Alasky, a major architect of this plan and coiner of the term compassionate conservatism, was influenced by prominent Reconstructionists and cited many in his books. In Florida, Jerry Regeer, appointed in 2002 by Jeb Bush to head the State Department of Children and Families, was identified by the Miami Herald as having drafted a Reconstructionist manifesto for the Christian Rights Council on Revival in 1989. On this dimension, at least, the two men have been willing to turn to Reconstructionists. Three national organizations, influential but hardly household names, the Council for National Policy, the Council on Revival, and the Committee to Restore American Values, were established in the 1980s, with Tim LaHaye and others sharing Christian Right or John Birch Society backgrounds taking a role. All three have had a considerable number of Reconstructionist members and board members. In a 2002 report, ABC News described the CNP as the most powerful conservative group you've never heard of. Let me stipulate. Reading about the webs and connections between Reconstructionism and the rest of the religious right set out in progressive and liberal publications calls to mind the exposés published by conservatives 50 or 60 years ago that linked various progressive organizations to communist front groups and fellow travelers. The release in recent decades of old Soviet files has confirmed some of what the conservatives were charging, and today's liberal and progressive muckrakers are probably just as accurate in suggesting a larger-than-realized influence of Christian Reconstructionists. As George W. Bush's second term began in 2005, religious issues from abortion to the First Amendment underpinned conservative desire to take over as much as possible of the federal judiciary. That April, columnist Frank Rich quoted Tony Perkins, the president of the Family Research Council, telling a Washington conservative assemblage that the judiciary poses a greater threat to representative government than terrorist groups. While Perkins's analogy seems radical, others on his side have been just as aroused, just as belligerent. The federal judiciary is the arena in which the battle is most critical to incipient theocrats, those over sex, life and death issues, church-state separation, and the global contest between good and evil will be fought out judge by judge, court by court. Indeed, in their anxiety to control the federal judiciary, Christian conservatives have matched or exceeded the efforts of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the liberal Democrats to control it on behalf of the New Deal when FDR submitted his famous proposal to pack the U.S. Supreme Court in 1937. Signs of that anxiety burst into view in an early 2005 meeting at which conservative evangelical leaders were addressed by Tom DeLay and Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. The focus of the strategy session was how to strip funding or jurisdiction from federal courts, or even eliminate them. From federal courts, James Dobson of the California-based Focus on the Family named one target, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Very few people know this, that the Congress can simply disenfranchise a court, Dobson commented. They don't have to fire anybody or impeach them or go through that battle. All they have to do is say the Ninth Circuit doesn't exist anymore, and it's gone. A spokesman for Frist said he did not agree with the idea of defunding courts or shutting them down, but DeLay, who had once said, "We set up the courts, we can unset the courts," declined to comment. The battle, clearly, is only beginning. Beyond the judiciary, pressure for theological correctness became overt in federal government relationships with the varieties of science, from climatology to geology and even entomology, that can conflict with the Book of Genesis, scriptural home to Adam, Eve, Noah, and the animal-laden ark, and fount of authority for God's creation of the earth in more or less a week, some 6 to 7,000 years ago. For the growing number of elected officials who uphold Genesis, Southern Baptist Convention leaders say that George W. Bush believes the Bible is the truth with a capital T, the Almighty, not carbon dioxide, brings about climate change. Global oil resources date back only to the creation, not to the Jurassic Age. The consequences here go far beyond the evolution-doubting books being sold by the National Park Service, or inconvenient information about contraception, climate change, or caribou habitats in oil lands being deleted from government websites. The implications also go far beyond the Tennessee school texts that William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow fought over in the Scopes trial. 8 decades ago, the federal government was not involved in the controversies. Nor did the geography of the Republican electoral coalition require President Calvin Coolidge to worry about offending the Southern Baptist Convention or the Assemblies of God, or to risk making the United States look foolish in the eyes of the international scientific community. Today, the SBC and the Assemblies of God are Washington power brokers, and much of the U.S. scientific community is up in arms. In 2001, when the National Academy of Sciences presented the new president with a study laying out the perils of global warming, he paid no attention. The administration's preferred HIV treatment, abstinence-only sexual education, has been identified as medically unsound by the National Institutes of Health, the American Medical Association, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. Hearings by a Food and Drug Administration panel on a pregnancy pill snubbed the 45,000-member American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists in order to hear from the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, with 1/10 the membership. The examples in this vein are many. Michael Mangiello, a leader of the Coalition for the Advancement of Medical Research, backers of stem cell research, told an interviewer that at a major hearing, the prestige gap between our scientists and their scientists was overwhelming. But religious forces had the president's ear. In late 2003, when the Grand Canyon Bookstore began selling a creationist interpretation of the canyon's origin, 7 national geological organizations wrote to caution the National Park Service against giving the impression that it approves of the anti-science movement known as Young Earth Creationism or endorses the advancement of religious tenets as science. Against the recommendation of the Park Service's senior geologist, the book remained on sale. In a 2003 controversy over Bush administration pressure on the Environmental Protection Agency, Russell Train, its director under Republican Presidents Nixon and Ford, wrote, "I can state categorically that there was never such White House intrusion into the business of the EPA during my tenure." The 2004 election year saw the issuance of a statement on restoring scientific integrity in policymaking by 62 preeminent scientists, including Nobel laureates and former advisors to administrations of both parties, which charged the administration with widespread and unprecedented manipulation of the process through which science enters into its decisions. As an adjunct, the Union of Concerned Scientists released detailed documentation of alleged suppression and distortion of scientific findings and manipulation of the government's scientific advisory system. Observers noted that the credentials or motivations of Bush's allies were often religious. The New York Times observed that David W. Hager, then one of Bush's nominees to the influential Food and Drug Administration panel on women's health policy, had a resume more impressive for theology than gynecology. Former Republican Senator John Danforth of Missouri commented that the only explanation for legislators comparing cells in a petri dish to babies in a womb is the extension of religious doctrine into statutory law. In Texas, where the cotton industry is plagued by a moth that has evolved an immunity to pesticides, a frustrated entomologist commented that it's amazing that cotton growers are having to deal with these pests in the very states whose legislatures are so hostile to the theory of evolution. Because it is evolution they are struggling against in their fields every season. These people are trying to ban the teaching of evolution while their own cotton crops are failing because of evolution. Opponents of evolution, successful so far in parts of the South, are indeed busy trying to ban the teaching of it and textbooks that support it in many northern conservative or politically divided areas, including large states such as Michigan, Missouri, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. However, the latest effort is more than a replay of the Scopes confrontation. Creationism now shares its educational stage with a slick city cousin, so-called intelligent design, hypothesizing simply that some intelligence produced the universe. The latter is a tactical response to a major court case in 1987, Edwards versus Aguillard, which found that creationism promoted a religious viewpoint, not a scholarly one. Intelligent design, seeking classroom acceptability, has kept vague enough about its religious motivations to avoid the Edwards yardstick, but its lack of serious science is a significant handicap. Some of its founders also have ties to Christian Reconstructionism. Still, public opinion is certainly open to the theory of intelligent design, so the battle is far from over. Meanwhile, the bigger message, depressingly reminiscent of our imperial predecessors, is that science in the United States is already in trouble. Money is draining out, with dire consequences. Intel chairman Andrew Grove says critical scientific infrastructure spending is being neglected, and the premier research universities are losing their edge. Susan Hockfield, the president of MIT, says, "We're falling behind. We're not keeping up with other countries. The science and math scores for our high school graduates are disastrous. We are underfunding research in the physical sciences and lagging seriously on publications in these sciences." Stanford professor Irving Weissman, a stem cell researcher, told the Boston Globe, "You are going to start picking up Nature and Science and all the great journals, and you are going to read about how South Koreans and Chinese and Singaporeans are making advances the rest of us can't even study." In 2005, the Business Higher Education Forum released new data showing that 15-year-old Americans are worse at problem-solving than their peers in 25 countries. Something else young Americans don't seem to understand, perhaps not surprisingly, is evolution. In 1993, an international social survey ranked Americans last, behind Bulgaria and Slovenia, in knowledge of the basic facts of evolution. Part of the explanation involves the religious right's larger view of economic matters and the dismantling of government. In the radical Texas Republican platform adopted in 2004, the Lone Star GOP was not content to call for abolishing the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Energy. It also demanded the abolition of the Internal Revenue Service and the elimination of the income tax, the inheritance tax, the gift tax, the capital gains levy, the corporate income tax, the payroll tax, and state and local property taxes. Apparently, the White House was not embarrassed. We have seen in previous chapters that evangelicals, Southern Baptist Convention adherents, and others oppose government social and economic programs because they interfere with a person's individual responsibility for his or her salvation. One recent scholarly analysis updated evangelical economic thinking to include the role of televangelists, specifically Falwell and Robertson, in upholding a marriage between religion and American capitalism during the 1980s. It further elaborated on theology increasingly espoused by Pentecostal and charismatic preachers, that God's blessings are not confined to the next life. Indeed, God desires to bless his children materially in this world. By naming what you want, a new car, better job, good health, claiming it in the name of Jesus, and living in the faith that it will come to you, these believers no longer tied private property to the notion of hard work. The permissive theology involved known as Name It and Claim It, originated with Oklahoma televangelist Oral Roberts, but crested under the aegis of Bruce Wilkinson, founder of the Atlanta-based Walk Through the Bible Ministries. According to historian James German, this movement reached its apex at the end of the 20th century with the immensely popular 92-page book, The Prayer of Jabez. Heretofore an unknown character in the Old Testament, Jabez became the hero for many. More than 5 million books were sold, who daily repeated his simple prayer. Oh, that you would bless me indeed and enlarge my territory, that your hand would be with me, and that you would keep me from evil that I may not cause pain. Tying the ancient supplication to modern life, author Bruce Wilkinson claimed that if Jabez had worked on Wall Street, he might have prayed, "Lord, increase the value of my investment portfolio." Others were diverted by rapture and end times possibilities. Overall, this kind of teaching has certainly stifled social consciousness among evangelicals, said Tim Weber, professor of church history at Northern Baptist Theological Seminary. If Jesus may come at any minute, then long-term social reform or renewal are beside the point. It has a bad effect there. Peter Peterson, a lapsed Republican who had earlier been Secretary of Commerce, could also plausibly blame GOP tax cut theology for his bête noire, federal deficit spending. Tax reduction, he said, had become a matter of faith. All kinds of quasi-religious explanations were converging in the makeup of party policy, leaving faithful economic stewardship the loser. In the Crusaders' footsteps, the Anglo-American Achilles' hubris? Since Islam and Christianity began fighting in the 7th century, the Holy Land has often brought disillusionment. After the Crusades, all 9 of them, after the fall of Constantinople in 1453, and 5 centuries later for the British in particular after World War I. Unmindful Western nations may still be playing out the Crusader hand. As we will see, in the months before George W. Bush sent U.S. troops into Iraq, his inspirational reading each morning was a book of sermons by a Scottish preacher accompanying troops about to march on Jerusalem in 1917. One of the more chilling themes of world history is the relationship between great wars and religious ambition. Holy war inflames religion into arrogance, and as all 4 of the nations we have examined were passing their apogees, there was talk about the Antichrist and Armageddon, one of Christendom's familiar mass excitements. 5th-century Romans, whose forebears had cursed Nero, now damned the Vandals and Huns. After the Reformation, popes and Spanish kings became the Antichrist to Protestants. Then when France emerged as the major threat to Dutch power in 1672 and thereafter, the Netherlands named Louis XIV the Antichrist. The papacy, in turn, gave crusade-like status to the Habsburg-Spanish battle against Protestant heresy. Although the Europe of 1900 to 1914 represented the world's most advanced civilization, talk of Armageddon and crusadership flourished. By 1914, military recruiting posters showed St. George, St. Michael, angels, and even Christ in the background. When hostilities began, German churchmen preached holy war in the East against Russia and in the West against atheistic France. Kaiser Wilhelm himself also pretended to be a Muslim sympathizer to bolster his alliance with Turkey and ambitions in the Middle East. Britons, however, singled out the Kaiser and became almost manic over the return of the Hun and the threat to world civilization, against which God had marshaled his chosen island people. The most extreme blessing of the canons came from the Bishop of London, A.F. Winnington Ingram, who called the war a great crusade, we cannot deny it, to kill Germans. He advised the Guardian that if you ask for my advice in a sentence as to what the Church is to do, I answer, mobilize the nation for a holy war. We have seen that between 1870 and 1914, the British developed a national psychosis of war expectation, and the United States displayed a lesser version in 1917 to 1918. Several books have been written about the U.S. Church's militants, for the rhetoric among U.S. clergy was as overblown as any in Europe. The fuller U.S. parallel developed out of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. In the late 1970s and 1980s, the nascent religious right became a vocal participant, with prominent evangelical ministers arguing that Christianity could not convert the world for Christ with Soviet atheism in the way. From Ronald Reagan's White House down to grassroots congregations, the Soviet Union, the evil empire, became a biblical as well as ideological foe. Struck in the early 1980s by world turmoil seeming to match the prophecies of the Bible, Reagan brought up the A word, Armageddon. In those years, end times preachers named the USSR as the evil confederation supposedly referred to in the Bible. When the Soviet Union collapsed between 1989 and 1991, U.S. religious conservatives quickly identified a roster of replacements. Islam as the primary evil force, and Iraq and Saddam Hussein, respectively, as 1. The re-embodiment of the evil Babylon, and 2. The leading new contender for the role of Antichrist. While few U.S. office holders indulged any candor, many evangelicals and fundamentalists did. In 2003, Richard Cizik, vice president of the National Association of Evangelicals, told the New York Times that evangelicals have substituted Islam for the Soviet Union. The Muslims have become the modern-day equivalent of the evil empire. This gains plausibility if we think about how the U.S. enthusiasm is at least partially replicating the evangelical, crusading, and Armageddon-flavored floundering in the British Empire during and just after World War I. Then, as now, British and American sanctimony reinforced each other, and the naivete and global moralizing that Woodrow Wilson added to British misjudgment would be equaled in 2003 by British Prime Minister Tony Blair's reinforcement of Washington's missteps in Iraq. The U.S. political backdrop to post-September 11th involvement in the Middle East also involved the biblical lens that much of Bush's constituency uses to view events in the Holy Land. As I detailed earlier, the 65-70% of the 2004 Bush electorate that are born again or that believe in Armageddon represent the party's essential constituency. Thus, just as scholars of the British war mentality in the years prior to 1914 do well to study the patriotic bombast of the music halls, the stanzas of Onward Christian Soldiers, and the endless books predicting German invasions, fathoming the Bush electorate requires its own study materials. In communications terms, the White House has depended on what Bruce Lincoln, David Domke, and other experts have called double coding. The biblical allusions that cluster so thickly in some speeches that the faithful among his listeners respond warmly. With so many liberty and freedom, good versus evil speeches year after year, Bush made himself a bridge between politics and religion for a large percentage of his electorate, cementing their fidelity. Meanwhile, portions of the Christian right message, too radical and divisive to be voiced directly from the Oval Office, went out through a network of preachers with whom Bush and his advisors kept in touch, could not endorse, but conspicuously never disavowed. These, of course, are stalwarts of the rapture, end times, and Armageddon, such as Tim LaHaye, Jerry Falwell, John Hagee, and Jack Van Impe, whose books and television ministries reached half of the Bush electorate. Their radical and over-imaginative interpretation of the Bible relentlessly magnified that of a defrocked Anglican priest, John Nelson Darby, who visited the United States 8 times during the 1860s and 1870s and ultimately gained far more adherence in the New World than he ever did in his native British Isles. In a nutshell, what Darby proclaimed, and what spread like wildfire through the hugely successful books of Cyrus Scofield, the 1909 Scofield Reference Bible, Hal Lindsey, the late great Planet Earth, 15 million sales through many editions since the 1960s, and Tim LaHaye, the Left Behind series, with multimedia sales in the 60 million range, is a world of turmoil now in the last of 7 periods, dispensations, that will end with the rapture of true believers suddenly pulled into the sky to be with Christ. Next follows the 7-year tribulation, when the satanic Antichrist will arise in Europe and seize world power. At its end, Christ and his armies will triumph in a great battle in Har Megiddo, near Haifa in what is now Israel. From Jerusalem, Christ will proclaim the start of a 1,000-year reign of peace. Through the 1990s, at least, most serious commentators ignored these books and broadcast ministries. But the election of George W. Bush, followed by the nation's post-September 11th responsiveness to a religious dialogue of good versus evil, sparked growing attention to LaHaye's series. In 2003, University of Wisconsin historian Paul Boyer, an expert on religious prophecy, estimated that upwards of 40% of Americans believe that Bible prophecies detail a specific sequence of end times events. To Boyer, religion's huge and unrecognized role in policy formation was on display in the shadowy but vital way that belief in biblical prophecy is helping mold grassroots attitudes towards current foreign policy. As the nation debates a march toward war in the Middle East, all of us would do well to pay attention to the beliefs of the vast company of Americans who read the headlines and watch the news through a filter of prophetic belief. The Bible includes no specific sequence of end times events, as most theologians point out, so belief that it does is largely a product of a century of amplified Darbyism, which is consummated in the Left Behind series. Boyer's thesis is true enough. Similarly, liberal observer Esther Kaplan analyzed the Left Behind series' themes and arguments and concluded that Bush's Middle East policy perfectly aligns with the religious worldview of LaHaye and his millions of readers. My own analysis, after reading several of his novels, is similar. It was eerie, especially in the first few volumes published in the 1990s, to see so many Bush administration foreign policy qualities anticipated. A global tribulation of good versus evil, the falsity of the United Nations, the emergence of an Antichrist from Europe, the complicity of the French, the building of the Second Babylon in Iraq, and its emergence as the headquarters of the Antichrist. Theologian Barbara Rossing, a professor of New Testament studies at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, argues that the rapture and the dispensationalist chronology is a fabrication. The dispensationalist system's supposedly clear-cut answers rely on a highly selective biblical literalism, as well as insertion of non-existent 2,000-year gaps and obvious redefinition of key terms. The system is not true to a literal reading of the Bible, as they claim. Not only is this a dangerous and false view of God and the Bible, but the events where dispensationalists identify the Bible's cosmic plan coming to life are most of all world wars, bloody crashes, earthquakes, diseases, and other violent cataclysms. Disasters of sickening magnitude are welcomed by prophecy buffs because they evoke feelings that God is present and alive. Regretting how rapture and Armageddon scenarios tap into Americans' love for disaster films and survivalist plotlines, Rossing posits the ultimate left-behind message. God so loved the world that he sent World War III. Still, for many of LaHaye's readers, the events of September 11th squared with the series' cultural and political message. Small wonder that, according to a Washington Post poll in September of 2003, some 70% of the population thought that Saddam, as the evil one, was involved in that day's attacks. Three Catholic authors contributed rapture critiques that were well received in the Catholic press and elsewhere. Carl E. Olson's study, Will Catholics Be Left Behind?, appeared in 2003. Paul Thigpen's The Rapture Trap was published in 2001, and David Curry's Rapture, The End Times Error That Leaves the Bible Behind, came out in 2003. Compared with these, the mainline Protestant rebuttal was sparse. Still, the theological dismissals of the rapture certainly represent the view of mainline U.S. Protestantism, as well as most of the U.S. Catholic hierarchy. An ounce of prevention, in a theological sense, would have been worth a pound of cure. In explaining readers' reactions to the series, Amy Johnson Frickholm reported that women in particular said over and over that the novels bring the Bible to life. For many, the dispensational script brought these images into a scheme of logic, assimilating them into a cosmic story they can understand. because mainline Christianity had not paid serious attention to the Cyrus Schofield, Hal Lindsey, Tim LaHaye viewpoint during the 1970s and 1980s, when the Christian right was resurging, no contradictory theological foundation had been laid. As a result, the left-behind message flooded persuasively into the thought processes of a considerable segment of American Protestants. The rapture is just one dubious element of so-called dispensational premillennialism. However, before we look at premillennialism's impact on U.S. policy in the Middle East, it is useful to recall the calamitous pre-World War I legacy of British evangelicalism, moral imperialism, and religious hawkishness. In some ways, although certainly not all, the United States picked up the evangelical baton Britain dropped nearly a century ago. And ironically, few Americans were more aware of Britain's 1917 invasion of the Turkish-controlled Holy Land than George W. Bush. Just before the U.S. attack on Iraq in 2003, Newsweek ran a cover story on Bush's defining religious journey, from reveler to revelation. In it, Howard Feynman described the president's immersion each morning in a book of evangelical sermons by Scottish Baptist Oswald Chambers. An itinerant preacher, Chambers spent his last days bringing the gospel to Australian and New Zealand soldiers massed in Egypt in late 1917 for the invasion of Palestine and the intended Christmastime capture of Jerusalem. The Britain that let itself drift into the First World War was caught up in many psychologies relevant to early 21st century America. The tide of evangelical, largely nonconformist Protestantism, despite important left-leaning and anti-war currents, was even more powerfully associated with the moral and political aura of the empire. Witness the evangelicals who became imperialist symbols. David Livingstone, the explorer. General Charles Gordon, slain in Khartoum, and General Sir Henry Havelock, hero of the relief of Lucknow in the Indian Mutiny. The same moral insistence also spurred the 19th century British Christian foreign missionary movement. By 1914, many British churches were all but draped in flags. According to historian Arthur Marwick, ministers of religion had embarked with enthusiasm upon the Holy War. The church, as the minister of St. Giles Cathedral, Edinburgh, later recalled, to an unfortunate degree had become an instrument of the state, and in too many pulpits, the preacher had assumed the role of a recruiting sergeant. Almost every place of worship throughout the length and breadth of the land displayed the Union Jack, generally placed above the holy table, while some had great shields carrying the flags of all the allied nations. I said many things from my pulpit during the first 6 months of my ministry that I deeply regret. It is no excuse to say that many preachers were doing the same thing. Apart from any immediacy of Armageddon, wartime involvement in the Middle East had its own biblical dimension. More than any other European people, 19th and early 20th century Britons spoke of resettling Jews in the historic land of Israel. This inclination dated back to the 17th century rule of Oliver Cromwell, whose Puritan belief in Scripture led him to readmit Jews to England – they had been expelled in 1290 – and to express hope for their eventual return to Judea. Two imperially minded 19th century prime ministers were also well disposed – Benjamin Disraeli, who promoted the idea in a book, and Viscount Palmerston, who thought a British client state in the Middle East would be geopolitically advantageous. By 1915, the subject came before the British War Cabinet, at this point unsuccessfully, where its principal supporter was Chancellor of the Exchequer David Lloyd George, a liberal whose poor Welsh constituency had been part of the great 1904 to 1907 revival. Moreover, as one historian has noted, he had been brought up by his uncle, who had been a preacher in a fundamentalist Welsh Baptist sect with a tradition of interpreting the Bible quite literally. As Prime Minister from 1916 to 1922, Lloyd George would be a key to British focus on the Middle East. The increasing familiarity of conflict with Islam was a further barometer of London's thinking. After the 1857 mutiny in India, as British occupation moved northwest toward the Khyber Pass, the foes were Muslim Khans and tribesmen. The great game itself was played in a Muslim arena, Afghanistan, Persia, India's northwest frontier province, and Russian Central Asia. So, too, for the military expeditions of Generals Kitchener and Gordon in Egypt and the Sudan, as well as the outposts of empire in northern Nigeria, Aden, Zanzibar, British Somaliland, and the Malayan Straits settlements. As the Ottoman Empire tottered, Muslim lands became the next arena of European imperial ambition. Britain's Armageddon rhetoric had a broader origin. In The Road to Armageddon, Cecil Eby summarized that increasingly, in England, Armageddon became a popular catchphrase referring to an apocalyptic war that would be fought at some time in the future. Thus, when war finally broke out with Germany in 1914, H.G. Wells's famous phrase, "the war that will end war," caught the public fancy because it appeared to fulfill St. John's prophecy of the war between the legions of God and Satan, conveniently defined as England and Germany, respectively. In later years, the war's extensions into the Middle East and reconquest of Jerusalem in 1917, proximate to the old Megiddo battlefield, added force. The poet Rupert Brooke had written in the early days, "Well, if Armageddon's on, I suppose one should be there." By the time Sir Edmund Allenby took Jerusalem in late 1917, an additional analogy was being superimposed. Major Vivian Gilbert's narrative, The Romance of the Last Crusade, with Allenby to Jerusalem, took its title from Allenby's supposed remark on entering the Holy City, "Now the Crusades have ended." On the other hand, when Allenby was advanced to the peerage, he became Viscount Allenby of Megiddo and Felixstowe. The romance of the Crusades was alive and breathing strongly. As French and British imperialism moved into the lands of Islam during the 19th century, both nations turned out books with titles like The Cross and the Crescent, and art like Delacroix's painting The Entry of the Crusaders into Constantinople. When plans to carve up the Middle East took shape during the war, the French evoked the old Crusader kingdoms of the 12th and 13th centuries ruled by Frenchmen such as Godfrey de Bouillon. The British, having the legends of Richard the Lionheart but no actual Crusader kingdoms to evoke, more or less decided to put their chips on a Jewish Anglo-American client state within the same boundaries. In his memoirs, Lloyd George recalled being brought up in a school where I was taught far more about the history of the Jews than about the history of my own land. During the course of the war, he called Britain's role that of the Good Samaritan and enjoyed discussing the names and places in the Holy Land. He also provided critical support for a post-war Jewish homeland under British auspices and for the late 1917 British invasion of Palestine. British policymakers closed out the war in 1918 with a rising conviction that the Middle East was where Britain would find its post-war imperial expansion. German East Africa had been captured, Egypt became a formal British protectorate in 1919, and Persia became an informal one, leaving the Holy Land, Palestine, Jordan, and Mesopotamia as the missing link in complete British dominance from Cape Town to Burma. Pushed by Lloyd George, Britain had, by the end of 1918, sent 1,084,000 British and Commonwealth troops into Ottoman territory to control the carving up, and the so-called settlement of 1922 fulfilled British ambition. Nevertheless, by 1922 to 1923, British policymakers knew that the foundations of these ambitions had collapsed. Many troops had been withdrawn in 1919. And then Britain's economy fell into a deep downturn in 1920 and 1921. Mesopotamia, Iraq, was restive. Shrunken budgets forced cutbacks in imperial ambition, and Lloyd George's coalition government was defeated in the 1922 general election. As this took place, Palestine, Jordan, and Iraq became dusty way stations of an empire in decline, not one still cresting toward a greater future. As early as 1919, Britain urged the United States to take up a peacekeeping role in Constantinople and Armenia, but Congress declined. Slippage at home was visible in the inability of British churches to command their former respect and Sunday attendance. The Church of England lost public confidence through its thoughtless wartime flag-waving, and the largely evangelical nonconformists lost ground because their war support, Many had been caught up in the drumbeat of moral imperialism by 1914, mocked their earlier peacetime priorities and preoccupation with social progress. Church-going lost its quasi-obligatory status for middle- and upper-class Britons, reducing attendance to only 15 to 20% of the population in the 1940s. How much of this misfortune might repeat in the even more evangelical and morally assured United States during the 21st century can be no more than a matter of speculation. But while the lessons of Rome and Spain are distant and only minimally relevant, that is not true of evangelical Protestant Britain, marching proudly and naively to war under the same hymns still sung at Iowa church suppers. British observers were appalled in March 2003 to find that George W. Bush had been transporting himself back to the Allenby years through his Oswald Chambers readings. In a column for the Times of London, Ben McIntyre regretted that Bush's focus was not the grimly inspired ironies of Siegfried Sassoon and Robert Graves, nor the poignant, painful questioning of Wilfred Owen. Instead, he was absorbed in the 1917 advice of evangelical war chaplain Chambers, whose counsel was to put aside any consideration other than God's will, to surrender your will to Him absolutely and irrevocably, and become more and more ablaze for the glory of God. For Chambers, said the Times, the enemy was evil, religious duty was clear, and Christian soldiers marched onwards in a straight line. Events in the Middle East had been part of Britain's post-World War I debacle. Nearly a century later, the error was about to be blindly repeated by a president of the United States who shared Lloyd George's biblical frame of reference, thought the enemy was evil, and failed to profit from the larger lesson taught by history. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, America has taken up the war whoops of militant Protestantism, the evangelical Christian missionary hopes and demands, the heady talk about bringing liberty and freedom to new shores, the tingle of the old Christian-Muslim blood feud, the biblical preoccupation with Israel, and the scenarios of the end times and Armageddon. The whole entrapping drama that played in British political theater a century ago. American evangelical, fundamentalist, and Pentecostal churches, in turn, have become the new flag-bearers of crusades against Islam's evil ones. According to national public opinion polls, evangelicals and their leaders far exceed other Americans in their disapproval of Islam. Two-thirds of these leaders consider Islam to be dedicated to world domination and a religion of violence. The anti-Muslim comments of prominent leaders of the Christian right, such as Falwell, Robertson, Franklin Graham, and former Southern Baptist Convention President Jerry Vines, confirmed evangelical leader Richard Cizik's contention about antagonism to Islam replacing hatred of the Soviet Union. Yet much of their activity purports to be missionary. Instead of British church people and Bible societies accompanying Queen Victoria's soldiers to India, we have U.S. missionaries following the flag to the Middle East. Prior to World War II, the mainline U.S. churches led missionary work, but today, says historian Paul Harvey, American foreign mission efforts are dominated by conservative evangelical groups, the Southern Baptist Convention and the Assemblies of God, the largest Pentecostal denomination, are the two largest senders of career missionaries, and Mormons, by far the largest sender of non-career missionaries. Indeed, after the prophecy wave of the early 1990s, the Southern Baptist Convention and other evangelicals reorganized their missionary activity to focus on Islam in the Middle East and North Africa. And in 2003, the New York Times reported that the number of U.S. missionaries in Islamic countries had doubled since 1990. By 2003, after a decade-long drumbeat by religious organizations urging the United States to defend foreign Christian populations, another page taken from British 19th-century experience, the principal evangelical churches were not just war supporters, but active mission planners. A year after the military took Baghdad, a survey by the Los Angeles Times found 30 evangelical missions in the city. Kyle Fisk, executive administrator of the National Association of Evangelicals, told the newspaper that Iraq will become the center for spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ to Iran, Libya, and throughout the Middle East. John Brady, head of operations of the Southern Baptist Convention International Missions Board in the Middle East and North Africa, said in a fundraising letter that events in Iraq represented a war for souls. Within 2 years, 7 new evangelical Christian churches had been launched in Baghdad alone. Some credited their humanitarian efforts, but the Roman Catholic Archbishop claimed they seduced Christians from other churches, and some Muslims complained about the proselytization. Whatever the effect, many in the Christian right